You're listening to Source Daily. Join us Monday through Friday to stay up to date with what's happening in North Central Ohio. We'll be sharing a closer look at one of our top stories, along with other news, local history, memorials, answers to your questions, and more. Today, we're sharing a conversation with Matthew Desmond that took place during last month's Kaleidoscope Community Conversations event. Matthew Desmond is a Princeton sociology professor and the principal investigator at the Eviction Lab. He's also the author of the award-winning book, Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Desmond shared his insights on poverty, housing insecurity, and public policy solutions. Before we begin, a quick message. Get ready for a sky-high aerial extravaganza at the 34th Annual Ashland Balloon Fest. From June 27th to June 29th, Freer Field transforms into a magical place filled with dozens of incredible hot air balloons, food, merchants, live entertainment, and fun activities for kids. Don't miss the spectacular balloon glows lighting up the night sky. Mark your calendars and join in for an unforgettable weekend. Visit ashlandballoonfest.com for more info. Now our feature story. Here's Matthew Desmond and Source Media Properties CEO Jay Allred.
What got you interested in studying poverty?
I grew up in a little town in northern Arizona, Winslow, Arizona. My father was a minister, and we never had any money. So we experienced some of the slights and indignities of poverty. We got our lights shut off and our gas turned off. And then finally, my family declared bankruptcy, and the bank took our home before it was all the rage. And I think that's what started it. You know, it wasn't like a moment of clarity for me or anything, but I think something worked its way in there when I was asking myself, why is this how a country handles a family when they fall in hard times? But I still was given the story about America, about the American dream. You work hard, you get ahead, you're going to be okay. And I went to college on a bunch of loans and scholarships, and I just kind of got a different story. You know, I was learning things in classes that weren't comporting with what I was being taught in my Boy Scout troop or my church. And so when I wasn't working, I was spending a lot of time in the library trying to figure out the nature of the country. And I started spending a lot of time with homeless people around the university, not serving them or providing socks or anything, just hanging out and listening and talking. And I think that got me down this path. And then for my last book, Evicted, I moved to Milwaukee and I spent some time with folks getting evicted from their homes. And that's when I saw a kind of poverty that I'd never experienced before. I saw grandmas living without heat in the winter. I was on this eviction move once. We show up at this house. I'm with the sheriffs this day. We knock on the door and this beautiful young girl answers. She's like 14. She has these stunning gray eyes. And so it takes the sheriff a little while to figure it out, but the mom had died and the kids had just gone to live in the house. And so the sheriff just evicted the kids. And they piled all the stuff on the sidewalk. It was like a cold spring day, rainy. Landlord changed the locks. Someone called social services, and we were off to the next eviction. I think seeing things like that gets to you.
When I read Poverty by America, the book felt personal to me, almost like you were writing a letter to America. The book is accessible, and it doesn't require a tremendous amount to read in the sense that it's short and readable. But it's clearly researched because the notes section alone is almost a third of the book. But it felt personal to me, a little different than Evicted. Can you talk a little bit about why you chose to write this book, especially as a follow-up to Evicted? Are those two things related? Is there a causal line between them? Why the books feel a little bit different when you read them?
Yeah, I felt a little like a fraud, I guess. After Evicted, I was going around talking about poverty and the housing crisis. I was teaching classes on inequality in college. And I just felt like if someone stopped me on the street and they're like, all right, break it down for me. You know, why is there so much poverty? What's your answer? I just felt like I didn't have an answer. You know, and, you know, Toni Morrison famously said she wrote the book she wanted to read. And I think for me, poverty was kind of book like that for me. I had to get it out of my system in a way. I needed to get down on paper what I thought was the main causes of poverty in America and how we could finally end it. I think the connection to Evicted for me runs through this one story in Evicted. Like the thing that changed my mind about poverty the most when I was spending time in Milwaukee was when my landlord in a mobile home park that I was living in opened up his books to me, like his accounting books, so that I could account for his like profit margins. And it took me a long time to figure out what he was taking home, because you got to account for all these expenses, vacancies and missed payments. And so it took me about a month, but I figured out that the landlord of the poorest mobile home park in Milwaukee was taking home over $400K a year after expenses. And his tenants were like literally collecting cans to make rent. And that's when I was like, oh,
okay. You have something here.
Right. When I started the work, I was like, if you had enough money to buy a trailer park, why would you buy a trailer park? And so I think that's when I was like, there's winners and losers, and there's losers sometimes because there are winners. And that's a different poverty story than the one we usually tell.
That's a great segue. I wish we had rehearsed it. Because one of the things that I saw that ran through poverty was Poverty by America, the book, was that there was a through line in terms of that I was interpreting that you think American poverty is sort of uniquely American, that there are some things about poverty in America that make it unique. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you've discovered as, you know, as you've researched poverty both in our country and around the world? But what makes American poverty uniquely American?
I mean, one thing is just how much of it we have. Like, you go over to Europe, like if you give a poverty talk in America, the audience is usually like, that's sad. That's a sad thing you just said. If you give a poverty talk in Europe, they're like, you don't have a civilization. Like, it's a totally different reaction. Europeans have this phrase, American style deprivation. And so our child poverty rate, for example, it's double Germany's, South Korea's, Canada's. We just have a lot more poverty than any other like advanced democracy with this kind of resources. And, you know, some of our poverty is really, really, really deep and entrenched. Economists have estimated that about 5 million Americans get by on $4 a day or less. You know, and then all the correlates of poverty, from dying young to eviction to incarceration, are just kind of more extreme in America than other advanced democracies. One of the differences, too, is, I mean, this gets a little wonky, but like this is kind of the big game of it. It's taxes. You know, we collect a lot fewer taxes as a share of our GDP than other advanced democracies. And when you go to those democracies, you can feel it on the ground level, including feeling a striking absence of street poverty that you see in other countries.
When I was reading the book, I thought it was really helpful, too, that you framed the discussion around America as it's compared to other advanced democracies in the world. You didn't frame the discussion around America and sub-Saharan Africa, or America and another country where poverty feels deeper. You framed us against our peers, which I thought was helpful in terms of trying to absorb and digest the thesis and the hypothesis in the book. And in fact, in the book, you point to a couple of maddening statistics to me anyway. Here they are. First, you cite that since 1980, the U.S. has increased investment in anti-poverty programs by at least 130%, or by as much as 237% if we include Medicaid. And to use your words, quote, the U.S. has not become stingier over time with anti-poverty programs. But on literally the following page, we learn that for every dollar budgeted to the TANF program, which is an acronym for Temporary Aid for Needy Families, just 22 cents of every dollar reached poor families in the form of direct aid. So my question is, what the hell is going on?
I heard two questions. One is this kind of story about increasing aid, and have we seen a return on that aid? Then a part or a sub question of that is like, does a dollar in the budget mean a dollar in someone's hand? So on that first question, right, you know, this makes some liberals very nervous, because they believe that if you claim that poverty's like been stubbornly persistent in the face of increasing anti-poverty aid, it means that you're implying that that aid doesn't matter, right? Like the old Reagan line, you know, we fought the war on poverty and poverty won. That's not my claim. So there's a ton of evidence that things like food stamps, housing assistance are lifesavers for Americans, lifting millions of Americans above the poverty line every year. But I think that we have to come face to face with the fact that we've kind of adopted a laissez-faire welfare state, like a welfare state that doesn't hit at the root cause of poverty. So just one quick stat. Federal investments in affordable housing have increased 16% in real terms since 2000. So you might be like, oh, Matt, that means 16% more people are getting affordable housing. But no, about 4.5 million families in 2000, 4.5 million families today. So why are we spending more to stay in the same place? Because the biggest thing we do to help folks afford the rent out there is to subsidize landlords in the private market. And if those vouchers that we hand out are responsive to rent increases, that means we have to pay more every year to house the same number of families. And the big takeaway for me is we don't just need like to turn the faucet on more. Sometimes we do, but we also need to rethink the fundamentals of how we do it. One of the things that we should recognize though is just because there's a dollar budgeted doesn't mean there's a person helped. So TANF is cash welfare. It's what Clinton famously revised mid-1990s. And when Clinton revised it, he made it a block grant, which is just a way of saying, okay, states, here's some federal money. You guys have some discretion about how to use it. And boy, do states use that discretion. Folks use welfare dollars to fund Christian summer camps and abstinence-only education and marriage counseling. Some states don't even spend it. Like Hawaii, the last time I checked, was sitting on so much unspent welfare dollars, they could give every poor kid in Hawaii like $10,000. So this isn't a red state or blue state thing. There's only one state in the country where most welfare dollars is realized as direct assistance to families, and that's Kentucky. And so when we're talking about this kind of inefficiency in the welfare system, we're like talking about kids not getting enough to eat, right? We're talking about kids getting evicted. We're talking about real pain that we've built into these systems.
That was something that as I was reading through the book and I was trying to research and get a really clear picture on this because I'm a long way from being an expert on it. So I was trying to do my own work.
Yeah.
I realized that like you can make a statistic or a dollar kind of dance. You know, there's a way that you can take the same statistic, you can tell a different story with it, and it can literally be the same statistic in different ways. And I was struck by the TANF dollars and that inefficiency of a dollar being budgeted into TANF and 22 cents making it to families. The fact that our neighbors in Mississippi to the south paid Brett Favre $1.1 million for speeches he never gave. Now, like, I'm a Cleveland Browns fan, so I hate Brett Favre anyway, but like that's like another reason to not like. There were professional wrestling promoters that were, I just felt like, wow, this is like the definition of a pork truck just being backed up. And it seemed to be, it didn't really matter which state it was occurring in. It spoke to me of government inefficiency in delivering aid.
Yeah.
But you talk a lot about the difference between program and a dollar in the hand. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, unless you read about this, when you say direct aid to the poor, what do you mean?
Oh, I mean connecting families to programs that they really can use. And we do a terrible job of doing that right now. So we hear about welfare dependency all the time. We heard about it nonstop in COVID. Remember, we were like, we're paying people to stay home. But the data did not show a lot of evidence for welfare dependency. The data show a ton of evidence for welfare avoidance. The fact that billions and billions of dollars every year in unused aid is left on the table because families aren't connecting to programs. So 7 million workers that could receive this wage subsidy called the Earned Income Tax Credit, they pass on it. That means they collectively pass on $17 billion a year. And if you add that up with the amount of money folks don't claim, like folks who could receive but deny themselves food stamps and government health insurance and supplemental security insurance and unemployment insurance, you're already up to like over $140 billion a year in unused aid. That's not a picture of welfare dependency. That's a picture of us doing a pretty bad job connecting those families to programs that they need and they deserve, frankly. We used to think the problem was stigma, that folks were too proud. I don't know if you've all ever spent time in a welfare office. I have. It is stigmatizing. But 100% of folks in Oregon who could receive food stamps do. And in California, about 63%. So it's not like food stamps are more stigmatized in California than Oregon. Something else is going on. And that something else is red tape, bureaucracy. You got to fill out 200 questions in California to get food stamps, for example. So this is both very maddening, because like this is America. If we do one thing really good, it's like marketing stuff to people and getting stuff to people. And also helpful. So why can't we take the ingenuity and technical know-how that we supply to make sure you get the mouthwash you want or the birdseed and supply that to making sure young moms get the WIC they need so they can feed their babies?
The last part of the book is devoted to how we could end poverty in America. What can the country do?
Sure. Maybe one way to answer that question is to ask a little different one, which is like, what can I do? Because the book makes this case that, you know, there's new policies and there's new political movements that are needed for sure. But it also requires that us, we have skin in the game. Because the book's main thesis is that a lot of us are connected to this problem, often unwittingly, and connected to the solution. And so the book makes this call for us to become poverty abolitionists and divest and unwind ourselves from the suffering of the poor. And there's a lot of ways we can do that, from our investment decisions, our consumption choices, where to live, how to vote, you know, those kind of things. I think with respect to what policies are needed or what are the steps we can take to end poverty, the first step is the recognition that like poverty can end in America, can end. We have the resources.
I don't pause on that for a second, because that's a relatively controversial thing to say, or it's a powerful statement to make. Because if you view poverty in America as this intractable problem that has been part of our experience, I don't know, since forever, there have been innumerable efforts that have been made to either address it in small ways, in big ways. And it feels to be almost the definition of intractable. It's the kind of problem that, will we ever find a solution to it? Is there one? Will there always be? So for you to say that we can end poverty in America, I want to know more about how you think we can.
When the Johnson administration launched the war on poverty in 1964, they literally set a deadline. They set a deadline for the end of poverty. You know, we once had these moral ambitions at the highest levels of government for an America without hunger and without scarcity. I feel like, why accept anything less? It feels very American to me to be like, let's abolish poverty. You know, and we've accepted this kind of like, you know, but we've settled for this idea of having to live with poverty. I think the biggest myth about poverty is that we have to live with it, that it's the poor will always be with us. So it would cost about $177 billion a year to bring everyone below the official poverty line above it. It's a rough estimate, but it gives us a sense of what we're talking about when we're talking about ending poverty, because what we're talking about is something like deliciously attainable for us. That's less than 1% of our GDP. So a recent study showed that if the top 1% of federal income earners just paid the taxes they owed, we could raise an additional $175 billion a year. So we could just about close the poverty gap if we just got really serious about making sure all of us pay the taxes we owed. So whenever I hear people saying like, well, we can't afford to do more, it just feels to me completely dishonest, like even a sinfully dishonest response to this idea. It's true that poverty has always been with us, but that doesn't mean that we've always had the same level of poverty. And there have been these historical moments when we've seen drastic progress in poverty because of government action. And we just had one in COVID, right? So the third rescue plan that the Biden administration released, the American Rescue Plan, was released about a year into the pandemic. And it did a few things. One thing it did, it took this boring thing called the Child Tax Credit, which was a middle-class credit for reasons I won't bore you with, and it tweaked it. And it was like, let's make it monthly, let's make it fully refundable, which means it can reach all the way down the income ladder. And that little thing reduced child poverty by 46% in 6 months. And so I think that, you know, one of the huge lessons that come out of COVID is we do not have to live with all this poverty, especially all this child poverty. And if we want to get serious about reducing it, we have the tools to do so.
One of the things that we talk about a lot at my company and within organizations that I'm involved in here in Mansfield is the idea of pivoting or shifting away from a scarcity mindset
right,
to an abundance mindset. Yeah. It's tough in the Midwest. Ohio has endured roughly a 30-year butt-kicking as a result of deindustrialization and trying to figure out what it's going to be after towns like ours and Youngstown and Akron had to reckon with this massive disruption in their lives. And so we've lived through this idea of, can we even think in terms of abundance? Can we even think about our future as something bigger than our past? Because we spent a lot of time in the 90s looking through the rearview mirror, pining for what was, and we didn't have enough time to think about what could be. I'm proud to say in our community and lots of communities here in Ohio, that shift is beginning to happen, and you can see it in cities. Talk a little bit about that idea of abundance versus scarcity as the way that you understand it in the book and the way that we as Americans can approach this kind of a problem.
So I think there's a few ways to cut at this question, and I love that you guys are talking about it in your company. And one way to cut at it is, I think we have to have this visceral, almost kind of violent reaction whenever we get this confrontation that the country can't do more to address social problems. It's almost like we have to treat it as like someone says something racist or something. We're like, whoa, why are you saying this? Because we just have so many resources in this country. And I think that we have to have a language that denies this kind of scarcity mindset that the richest country on the planet can't afford to make sure all of us have access to a dentist or all of our basic needs are met. We definitely have the resources to do that. But then there's a scarcity mindset in our own lives that I think we have to confront. We're very vocal about everyone's middle class now, everyone's struggling now, and we're less vocal about how many of us have plenty, more than plenty, and could probably take a little bit less, especially from the government. Like in COVID, Americans bought like 350,000 powerboats. That's a lot of powerboats. We spend billions of dollars every year on our pets, on Christmas trees. 1 in 8 of us have a second home. I think that one of the things to think about when it comes to the scarcity mindset is to think about our economic position in an honest terms sometimes. And also for those of us that have received some privilege in the country that are quite secure in our money, to really think about how we're beneficiaries of this kind of government largesse in ways that often elude us, especially through tax breaks and tax expenditures.
When I was getting ready for tonight, I read not only your book, but I read widely. I tried to get my arms around this topic that I don't understand very well, and frankly, come out with a certain degree of just kind of baked in assumptions. In your book, poverty has been met with very positive reviews in general, but it hasn't been immune to criticism. Reviews in Reason, the Cato Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, they write that you kind of missed the principal cause of poverty in America, or that perhaps it didn't fit into the rationale of the book, and so you didn't reckon with it. And one of the things that they cite, Matthew, is that a 2021 census report that among poor adults aged 18 to 64, less than 10% worked full-time year-round. That, to me, plays into sometimes the reflexive belief among middle-class Americans or working Americans that the poor are lazy. These sort of things that we just kind of reflexively believe after a while. That statistic did jump out at me. 10% and 90% is a big number. Talk to me about, like, is there any part of that argument that they make that makes any sense to you? Are they missing something about what you're trying to say in your book? They weren't scathing, but they were just questioning that. And I was interested in diving in with you a little bit on that.
Yeah, a book like this invites reviews like that. It's an argument book. And I would be embarrassed if everyone agreed with this book, I think, in a way. If we look at what's happened to work over the past 50 years, we have this slide, and Ohio knows this story very well. We've had this slide away from worker empowerment, right? 1970, 1 in 3 workers belong to a union. Wages are climbing 2% every year, inflation adjusted. CEO pay is reined in, and we experienced the most economically equal time in American history. But as workers lost power, our jobs got a lot worse. You know, like our grandparents had careers, our parents had jobs, and we complete tasks. That's kind of the story, the slide of the American working class and working poor anyway. And this is a key reason for poverty. You know, the inflation-adjusted wages for men today is less than it would have been 50 years ago. So the idea that you could just work your way out of poverty, but if you just put in enough time, you're going to get there, seems really out of step with what I'm seeing, not only like in the statistics, but on the ground, spending time with like women cleaning offices that have chemical burns on their arms and home health aides that can't like stand up straight anymore because, you know, they lifted so many people out of beds. And asking them to just work harder and work harder seems to be really like violent, you know, in a way. I think that one of the things that we do have to face, and I think that these conservative organizations that you quoted would agree with me, is that we have had this big decline in the labor force participation rate of men over the last 50 years. And we don't really understand it that well. There are quite a bit of working age men that seem to be opting out of the labor market in more and more rates. And we have to figure that out. Ascribing to the idea that they're just lazy seems to be a shortcut to thinking, you know, and I think we need to hold ourselves accountable to their lived experience. One of the challenges about writing a book like this, when it's such an old topic, like what do you include and what don't you include? Because a lot of times when we're having this debate, certain old ideas or old questions, they always get center stage. And no matter where we are in the debate, we're centering these small amount of questions. And this book really wanted to try to ask a different set of questions or to use a different metaphor to expand the aperture. So if the book has a thesis, it's this quote from Tommy Orange, right? Where he says, these kids are jumping out of the windows of burning buildings, falling to their deaths, and we think the problem is that they're jumping. So when I read that, I was like, that's the American poverty debate. And for over 100 years, we've focused on the poor, and we've asked every question we can about their work ethic and their kids and their welfare dependency, and we should have been focusing on the fire, I think. So this is a book about the fire.
Back in January, I was joined on stage by another MacArthur Fellow, Majora Carter of the South Bronx. She's working as a real estate developer to develop more equitable and inclusive real estate development practices at the grassroots level in the South Bronx, but also teaching her methods and working with communities all over the U.S. And when I read her book, one of the things that I was prepared for, and I asked her this on stage, was I said, I opened this book to page one and I was prepared for a full-throated impeachment of capitalism. Like, I was ready. Like, bring it on, Majora. And I say this as a capitalist. And what I found, though, as I read through the nuance of that book, was that was not what it was. It was about rethinking the way that our American enterprise system is deployed across communities which she defines as low-status communities. These would be also poor communities or everything that I looked at, Mansfield qualified as a low-status community, especially parts of our city. But when we spoke, she was fiercely critical of what she called a nonprofit industrial complex that essentially feeds off the poor by creating jobs, middle-class jobs, for people that help impoverished people manage their poverty but never actually lift themselves up out of it. It was rooted in her belief that ownership matters, wealth creation matters, that we need to give poor people the opportunities to grab onto the things that sometimes a person like me, maybe born on second base, has easier access to. And she lumps government programs right in there as well, in terms of this industrial complex that sort of benefits from there being poor people. You talk a lot about the fact that we all benefit from poverty in different ways. And I'm asking, do you think that the nonprofit industrial complex is a real thing? And is there a better way?
I guess I come at that question a little differently.
Okay, great.
And so depression hits and FDR's like, oh, the economy's busted and we need to like regulate the banks. We need to regulate the stock market. We need to give workers power. Like that's the New Deal, right? Like notice there was like, it wasn't like we need to give folks food stamps, you know? It was like, we need to make sure the market is fair and we need to make sure workers have a voice. There was only one cash program that came out of the New Deal. It was Social Security in miniature form. So fast forward to the war on poverty and the economy is like killing it. You know, it's like sunny days in 1964. And Johnson is like, well, if you can't make it in this economy, I guess like you're kind of busted, you know? And so here's some food stamps, you know, here's some public health insurance, here's more Medicaid. And so I think we moved as a country from like an interventionist welfare state that you got through Johnson. And ever since we've been kind of designing welfare programs in that kind of way, where what we mean by like government aid to address poverty is the government is kind of like a public financer of private goods. And there's good reason for designing welfare state like that, but it can be increasingly inefficient. Like if the cost of healthcare and housing rise, that means we got to spend more to stay in the same place. Or if you think about labor, like the biggest thing we do to help poorly paid workers today isn't to make sure labor law is funded or to make sure like unions or organizing is easy. We give them a wage bump called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's a huge program. It's $70 billion a year. Does it lift millions of people out of poverty? Absolutely. Like, is it good for those kids? Absolutely. Does it address the root cause of their poverty? No. And so I think that when we think about root causes, solutions to poverty, we have to think about programs that really do not accommodate poverty, but really disrupt it to cut it at the root. So what are some of those programs? One of the way you can think about that is we need to address exploitation in the labor market, housing market, and financial markets. So in the labor market, it means let's figure out ways of building worker power. In the housing market, it means we have to get away from this brutal system where most renting families have one choice if they're poor: rent from a private landlord and give at least half of what they have to the rent. And so we have to expand their choice. And in the financial market, to make sure we're not soaking the poor with $1 billion of fines and fees every single year. And so these are the kinds of programs that I see as more interventionist. Is there a nonprofit industrial complex? I don't know. You know, some nonprofits are amazing and they're doing incredible work, and some are less efficient. You know, so I think there's been a lot of written on that. I just haven't studied that directly.
I want to talk a little bit about working together for us in this room, because I guarantee you there's folks in this room tonight who walked in and they're fundamentally wired to disagree with the premise of your book. But I also know, after living in this community for 30 years and just being an adult and having two kids, is that you just don't solve problems like this either at the national level or at the local level by going it alone. There's a certain amount of grenade throwing, you know, there's any number of metaphors to describe this, but there's a certain amount of that you can do. But to actually do the hard work and to move the needle, you have to be able to work together. So where do you think there's places where people who accept that there's a problem? So for example, Mansfield's poverty rate is 25%. It's a lot, right? I mean, I looked that up on the Census Bureau and I was surprised to see it, but it's been sitting with me for a few days. Maybe differ on the cause of that number. Maybe we wonder about how we got there or how we get out. Where have you seen evidence of folks with maybe different viewpoints on that kind of stuff coming together? Where's the common ground, Matthew, where this doesn't become a political issue? We focus on the human beings that need the help that they need, and in order to be able to grow and move out of that and break that cycle that they're in. Because, man, digging into this and trying to get ready for this talk, I'm telling you, it was a little depressing.
And I think there's a lot of hopeful stories, actually. You know, that bumper sticker is like, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. Sometimes I think, like, if you're not hopeful, maybe we're not paying attention. Like, this is not a knock on you. It's just like, You know, I think it's like there's all this incredible common ground on this issue. The book concludes with this little story that I love from One Fair Wage, which is this group of workers that are fighting tipped work, like subminimum wage work. And they were doing this rally in Albany, and they're from New York City, so mostly Black and Latina women who are service sector folk. And it was the same day, it just happened to be the same day as a Stop the Steal rally. And so there's a bunch of white dudes in red hats, and they came over to the One Fair Wage guys, and they're like, what are you protesting? And the One Fair Wage folks are like, we want higher wages. And the MAGA guys are like, we want higher wages too. And they shook the women's hands and they joined the protest. And, you know, when you talk to folks on the ground doing that kind of work, you kind of get hopeful. They're seeing this all the time on the ground level. You can see it in the stats. You know, most Democrats and most Republicans today think the minimum wage is too low. Most Democrats and most Republicans today think the rich aren't paying their fair share. They're right. Most Democrats and most Republicans today, this is interesting, they report that, you know, poverty is a result of a structural failing, not an individual failing. So I do think things are shifting on the ground in a real way. This isn't to deny the clear divisions we have in the country, but on this issue, I think there's a huge overlap. The place where it gets tough, the place where hope kind of drains out a little bit, is translating that into real political action. On the ground, I think there is a lot of overlap and hope and commonality. There's another story in the book about these tenants organizing in Minneapolis that I spent a year
talking. I love that story. It was really interesting, the way that they approached this very localized problem.
Yeah, so they had a bad landlord, right? Undocumented immigrants, they spoke a lot of different languages, they were working at airports or overnight security. They communicated across Google Translate on their phone, and they started advocating to be homeowners. They asked the landlord to sell them the properties, and the landlord was like, okay, $7 million. And they're like, we'll be right back. And they started raising the money, and they got $7 million. But the landlord by that time was fed up, so he went to evict everyone. So they were either going to be homeowners or homeless. And it came to this jury trial, and we were sitting waiting for the jury to decide. And this one woman named Takara, who was a tenant, like face tattoos. And she was like, it's taking this jury so long. They're asking themselves, why do these tenants want this raggedy building? And it's because people have forgotten how to dream. No? Because I'm constantly asking, what can get through Congress? What can scale up? And I think that, you know, folks like Takara are just putting it in. They won that case and they're homeowners today. So I think part of the work is actually being okay with being a little bit more ambitious than we usually are.
To hear the rest of this conversation, make sure to tune in again tomorrow. You can also read our story about the event by clicking the link in our show notes. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow. Also, make sure to head over to richlandsource.com and click the Be a Member button to help support independent local journalism that informs and inspires. Every contribution goes to helping us make Richland County a better place and to help keep our journalism free. Also, if you like this podcast and want to hear more, make sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.